I think it helps.
I hope so.
I think it helps.
Hope so.
Maybe help us.
Hope so. I wish you would have been more successful.
Huh? Yeah.
I wish you would have been more successful in your attempt to make the bridge again.
No, I offer.
I know. People are silly, kind of. People are silly.
Yeah, I don't think it would take that much.
No, but you can do it. Who's honest?
Okay.
Nope.
So,
keep going.
Okay, so I'm speaking about the. How does this work with clients?
This over 2:30? When's this over?
2:40.
2:40.
2:40. Okay. Okay.
We won't go past 2:40.
Nah. So, okay.
You talk about. I'm happy to listen to you.
No.
You talk about it.
Okay, let me raise some general issues here, as I was asked to. Okay. The topic is dating. Okay, shidduchim from a halachic standpoint. But I know you've heard me talk about this, right? Probably to the point of nausea. You've heard me talk about it a little too much. Well, we've had about at least 2-3 classes on it in past several sites this year, much more than usual. So I'm going to look at it, obviously, from a very different end in terms of raising some questions. In my office this morning, I'll tell you something from my office this morning, something from my office earlier this week. Wild halachic shilas. Well, one's a wild shilas, the other is not so wild. In my office this morning was a very sad situation. It was a man who... a prominent member of our community who is about to get divorced. He was coming for help with how to protect the children as well as he could from the trauma, how do you tell the children, etc. The subject of Dr. Blumenthal's class last Friday, right? He was telling me that when he was dating, he found two things out about his kala. One was that she had a history of having been anorectic. The other is he heard some rumors that she had a history of having a borderline personality disorder. Okay? He didn't know what it meant. He just said, okay, it's I could deal with it. He figured he could fix her. All she needed was she didn't have such a loving home. All she needed was a little bit of love and a little bit of attention. And his life has been, one nonstop nightmare since then, for the last 10 years or so, where she's gone off and all kinds of horrible things that are outrageous, but what you'd expect from somebody with those diagnoses. He was crying, literally. He went through half a box of tissues in my office this morning, saying, had he only known... he said, if only somebody had taught him about this. And she said, no, he didn't know. So one of the issues I wanted to talk about, at least a little bit, is what are some of the questions that come up when you're dating somebody with psychiatric problems? At what point do you have to tell? Those are the halachic issues. But I want to talk about it a little bit from the psychological standpoint. That's just sort of like that. Then the other is just a wild question. I'm seeing somebody who is, it was probably a big violation of confidentiality on her part. But she's a lab tech at a hospital in the New York area. More than a lab tech, she's a higher level. She's actually a PhD who oversees the lab that does fertility research. And she was going through some lab tests as part of the research, and the father of the husband of one of her good friends, she was going through some of his lab tests as part of the research, but she knew about it. And she found out that it is impossible that he could have fathered a child. It's impossible. She said, you're not talking about a slight chance. You're talking about it is 100% impossible that this man had the fertility to have a child. And she knows, ever. Okay? She says that his kids are not his kids. Not his kids. He fully thinks. And she's very good friends with the family. It's not why she came to see me. She was seeing me for another reason.
So on the side.
She's on my lap, on the side. She says, this child, he has a son who's dating now. Okay? And what do you do? Okay? What do you do in a situation? Now, I don't know the name of the friend. I didn't ask. But maybe I should. But no, okay, right. But it's the kind of questions that that's number two.
Why is he testing himself? Why is his son in the way?
It was a violation of confidentiality. She's the fertility researcher.
He's not.
She has a big grant.
He still thinks it's infertility. No, he thinks he has four kids and then trying to have a fifth.
Yeah. He wasn't doing this for medical reasons.
Oh.
He gave her his. Whatever sample he gave was for the sake of
research
on improving fertility for people. So, you know, it's like some kind of this massive funding.
You learn a lesson. Don't ever do it.
Yeah.
Don't ever do it. Let science advance some other way.
Yeah. Okay. So that's
my first soccer.
The obvious question is, you know, this kid is going out now, you know, and there are all kinds of questions that get raised now that we know that the father is not really the father, okay? So sorry about that one. It happened yesterday. I figured I'd have to do this anyway. Okay. Let me just go through some specific stuff. Some of it you may have heard in casual psych class, but some of it will be chazara, some of it will be new. Okay. Number one, in terms of general guidelines on mental illness, is if you are a rav in a shul, or you're a rebbe, and you hear that somebody has either a history of serious bipolar illness, manic depressive illness, right? You know from the classes that it's cycling between serious depression, but also manic behavior, which may be marked by a lot of irritability, a lot of recklessness, a lot of irresponsible spending, etc., etc. We had a class that talked about that a little bit. So then there are two questions. So the question is, if you have bipolar illness, it could be very well managed with medication. It's really a chemical imbalance. You take a lithium-like medication, or there's some newer medications, and you could live really quite a normal life. So at what point do you need to tell? At what point in the dating process do you need to tell? Is there an argument to say that you don't need to tell if you've been stable for a very long time? And number three is, what do you do if you're the rub of somebody who had a history of really a bad episode of manic illness where he had to be hospitalized or she had to be hospitalized, and now you know they came out, they were doing well on medication, but they stopped taking their medication, and they haven't had a relapse, okay? But I'll tell you now, as a psychologist, that without medication, the chances of relapse are very, very high. So they may look fine now, but the odds of they're looking fine all the time over the next 10 years is not so high. So that's that. Schizophrenia is a little more less of a problem, because if somebody's schizophrenic, remember, that's not the popular notion of split personality. Schizophrenia means that you have delusions and hallucinations. It could be managed with medication, so you can have sort of a life, but you pretty much know when somebody's schizophrenic. So it's pretty obvious to somebody that this is a very odd person. But the question there also, this guideline there also, is that the schizophrenic is refusing to take his or her medication. It's very unlikely that they're capable of living as a husband and wife with somebody in any kind of real marriage.
Can they hide it long enough during the day, perhaps? Chassidim
can. Probably not. They might, right. Chassidim can.
2 seconds. Chassidim can. Engaged.
Chassidim, I have so many stories like that. So many stories like that.
Hide it, they go to Israel for 6 months.
Yeah.
come back and they get married, and it's super great.
Yeah. Right, and then they have another episode or whatever, and they can pull it together maybe a little bit, depending. That happens a lot. There's a lot of suffering in the Hasidic community because of that problem sometimes, where they keep it a secret and they don't tell about all kinds of secrets, and it's such a problem. Now, just to finish on the mental illness issue, then there's sort of the garden variety common cold of mental illness, depression and anxiety. Now, depression and anxiety, it ranges. You can have severe anxiety that really cripples the person's life and makes it very hard for them to live a normal life. But that'll pretty much be obvious to a person. But with medication, they can be very well managed. Then there are milder forms of anxiety. It's just during periods of transition in a person's life, they have a hard time. So usually during when they start high school, when they start college, when they start their year in Israel, and probably when they start marriage. I recently had somebody who I was seeing for on and off for quite some time, wonderful, wonderful young woman who was about to get engaged, wasn't sure at what point to tell a potential chassan that she had this kind of history. She was terrific, and she was managed well, and she wasn't even on medication that much anymore. And we called Zavid Cohn. Zavid Cohn specializes in these kinds of shilohs, and he said, it's very interesting what happened. He said, tell right away. He said, tell right away. He said, forget how often. He says, it's the right thing to do. They were ready beginning to get serious. I was ready to say she was beginning to get serious. And the young woman said, look, if I tell, he's going to break up with me. No way. He said, you know something? To start a marriage, as I would say, start a marriage on a lie is no good either. You have to tell. So she was very angry and very hurt and very upset. I felt betrayed. She had a very long family. She was very close to Zavid's family. And she told. And the guy said, so? Okay. And didn't even tell his parents, and they're doing great.
Yeah, the great. Was
it's really, that was it, that was it, yeah. So anyway, these are the kind of issues that get very complicated. Other issues, just sort of to tell you. Now I'll tell you again, as a psychologist, secrecy kills us. And we may not necessarily be agreeing on this part, but for example, I've known situations with diabetics, so juvenile onset diabetics, or somebody who has very bad, let's say, ulcerative colitis or rheumatoid arthritis, and they don't tell. And then it flares or complications come up, and it causes tremendous shalom bias problems more often than not. You know, to sort of go in with that kind of, I don't know if it's a mechachas, I don't know what it is, but to go in without telling, very often in certain segments of the community, people are told not to tell. And you can't keep these things secret very easily. They come out one way or another. So for the most part, secrecy of that type is a terrible way to start a marriage. The other issues that come up very frequently are questions about special needs children. When they start to go out, okay? And is it responsible to have somebody who's mentally retarded go on and get married? You know, let's say somebody who you don't think, somebody else who's mentally retarded, who's gonna care for their children? What do you do about those kinds of issues? That's a question that comes up. Or do they have the same right to happiness as anybody else? Are there mitzvah and puravu? And I don't know whether or not, and then there are all the gray areas, and at what point do they become shoset? At what point do they become sort of like halakhically under a category that would absolve them from puravu? Those are questions that come up fairly frequently also. Let me tell you another vignette and then a couple of closing comments. The other vignette is, again, very interesting, because just sort of to show you how this plays out. Number of years ago, I was working with a kid when he was just adopted. He was just put up by foster care by OHEL. So his parents couldn't care for him. And it turns out, and this is common, we didn't really know what his biologic parents' history was. We knew they were Jewish. We knew that the mother had a diagnosis of schizophrenia, which right away puts him himself at risk for that, but not at, let's say, 20% risk, okay? And his father had something else, but it was hard to tell because old-time diagnostic criteria weren't that clear. And he was adopted by this unbelievably wonderful family. It's a name you'd all recognize here. It's a very prominent rabbinic family. They adopted. They were unbelievable. They adopted, and they're just they're super parents. You know, like the most unbelievable, loving parents. They had a wonderful, wonderful childhood, and it was time for him to go out. And again, Rav David was involved, and I was told that they were told that whenever he set up at the point that he's going past a couple of days, they should the parents of the prospective kala should call me to review the history before they decide what to do. And it was heartbreaking because there was a girl that they were very, very much meant for each other, it seemed. He was all excited and she very much wanted to marry him. And it was the night before the Vart. And the parents hadn't called me until then. The parents called me and I had to be honest. And I explained it as best as I could. I said, look, here's what the, and I spoke to a psychiatric geneticist. You know, we don't know what the father's diagnosis was, so we can't take that in. Well, let's say there's and I made it as clear as possible. This is a wonderful kid who had unbelievable parenting. There might be genetic risk, but it's so hard to tell. There's always genetic risk. And the parents broke it off that night. But the end of the story is, again, I got a call, and it happened three more times, this time much earlier. He insisted that it happened earlier. Then I get a call from the most prominent family of all, an incredibly wealthy family, and wonderful family, and it was a better shidduch than any of them were, in terms of his level of excitement, but he was already ready to have it not work out. And the parents called me. And again, I had the same reaction. I told them the whole thing, I had the same reaction as Israel. They said, yeah, so what's your point? So I said, I don't have a point, I'm just telling you the facts. Here are the facts, you know. Here are the statistics. Wonderful boy, environment is more than half of what goes into what this kid's risk is. I think your daughter would be incredibly lucky to have somebody from such a wonderful family. But there's this other piece in terms of genetic risk. So the father said, but I still don't understand what your point is. So I said, I have no point, wonderful, you know. And they invited me to L'chaim the next night, you know. So the end of the story is, he's doing beautifully. This was about 15 years ago. He's doing beautifully. They have a bunch of children. They're all doing fine. Baruch Hashem, they're doing fine. You couldn't have done better than this kid. So the question, and then there's so many stories of where you just don't know. We don't know. I had a very interesting lecture. We had Brett Rantz at our hospital a couple of years ago, where there was a family that where the father was always blamed for the kid's problems. The kid was inattentive and fidgety, and he had a whole constellation of symptoms beyond just attention deficit. And the mother was always yelling at the father, "See, it's your genes, it's terrible." The lecture was a well-known geneticist shows us the genetic profile of the father and of the mother. She did a genetic analysis of them, and she shows that incontrovertibly, this was the mother's genes. Okay, so we never know. You know, you never know. There's like a tremendous amount of certainty that people have about certain things, and it's just not there. Okay, let me just do a quick chazar for you on what matters and what doesn't matter in dating. I don't know if it has implications for this, but for those, I think everybody here has been in Pastoral 1 or Pastoral 2. I just see a couple of unfamiliar faces. Pretty much everybody. Is there anybody? Who was it in Pastoral? So you've all had dating class. Yeah, it's just the, I see. Oh, that's perfect. That's right. Your brother, not you. Yeah. Okay, yeah. I'll just do a very quick review of what matters and what doesn't. And it's basically, first of all, there's a myth of an instant soulmate, and the myth has permeated into our society as well. In national studies, 94% of people say that they put the desire for their spouse to be their soulmate at the top of the mattering list. So people are looking for their soulmates. Okay, that's a real American myth. It's a Hollywood myth. And in reality, it's just a case, you probably don't need me to say it, but I'll say it. The reality is, that's a myth. That's not what goes into, there's not such a thing as a soulmate in that sense. Somebody who, I'm not talking about who your best share is. I'm talking about, you know, the love at first sight soulmate idea. Relationships are made, they're not like an instant thing. Relationships require work. There really is that, you know, ahava hav connection. There really is every reason to believe that relationships are invariably something that if they seem to work incredibly well right from the first sight, that's not the issue. That's not predictive of anything. What's predictive is what grows over time. So soulmate, yes, from a maybe mystical standpoint of who your best shared is. But soulmate is there being somebody who you just know is for you, and that there's this instant attraction, etc. That is nonsense. The real abiding relationship, the passion part of a relationship, has at most a 2-year shelf life in terms of keeping things together. At most, it's probably generous. What really matters with a relationship is the. I'm not talking about the physical aspects of a relationship, obviously. There it's different. That's where Taharas Mishpacha really is an unbelievable kind of protection against that. What I'm talking about is that what really grows a relationship is the ongoing day-to-day stuff. And you know that's why real love grows. And it grows as you learn how to sort of like have a shared life. Now, given that, what does matter? What does matter in dating is number one is shared dreams, a shared dream, right? So when I hear that somebody does not have a shared dream, every once in a while, after pastoral sites, somebody will ask to meet with me and they'll tell me they're going out with somebody who's very upset that they're going out with a guy who wants to be a rough, you know, and they really are not comfortable living that kind of lifestyle. You know, that's a dark red flag. That's a dark red flag, unless you want to give up being, you know, what your career dreams are. But if that's who you are, it just can't work. The shared dream is important, and that sometimes shows itself as Eretz Yisrael versus not Eretz Yisrael. But that often can be worked out. But if you really have divergent views and you think you're going to make them different or save them or somehow shape them, that's destined to be a problem. So that matters. How you fight matters. So again, you've heard from me a number of times about the work of John Mordechai Gottman, the Baal Teshuva with the Big Yarmulke, who has done 25 years worth of research where within 7 minutes of watching a couple fight, he can tell with 94% accuracy whether they'll be divorced in 5 years. Okay? And what are his predictors? His predictors of divorce are harsh startup. That's number one. Number one is the, you know, somebody, couples who write when they fight, they just start screaming and yelling at each other in a way that puts the other down. Okay? And then it's other symptoms of a relationship that's going to be, you know, problematic. It basically has to do with just where you don't have mutual admiration. You don't really look with admiration towards your partner and don't admire them. And then what dominates is criticalness, and what dominates is an inability to solve whatever is underneath the fight. It's not how much you fight that predicts the problem in a relationship. It's your ability to heal the fight at the end of the day, okay? So harsh startup is a huge problem, and if that's happening a lot, and a dating relationship is dominated by a lot of fighting and a lot of yelling and a lot of criticism, you know, I wish you'd be this way or that way, it's normal within a certain level of comfort, but if that's what's dominating, that's probably a yellow to red flag. Basic physical attraction probably does need to be there, even though it grows with time. Research shows the longer you're with the person, the more your model of what you become attracted to changes to match that person. So physical attraction definitely changes over time. So something you might see as a flaw at the beginning, you don't even notice as the relationship grows. And very often, the physical attraction becomes less and less of an important predictor, but there has to be at least a basic attraction there, probably. Although, again, many chassidim who are set up and hardly see each other, that works out that far sometimes. There's a lot of stories behind that word sometimes. Irrelevancies are the soulmate thing, subtle differences in backgrounds, parental profession, you're not marrying your in-laws, and any wedding-related conflicts are hevel and shudder silly. You know, the wedding-related conflicts are just ridiculous. You know, sometimes it's a sign of a problem, but those are basically irrelevancies. I could go on and on about this topic forever, but in terms of the bottom line, on mental health issues, if you're working with somebody where there's a question about a history of mental health problems in the potential chassan or kala, and it was a serious mental illness that was incapacitating the person who required a hospitalization, you probably should consult with an expert. Just to know, I get calls from Rabbanim all the time about this. I'm not an expert in the psychiatrics and genetics, but it's interesting. The leading expert in the world is a guy named Elliot Gershon in Washington, who happens to be a film guy. He's the man in this. And sometimes when there's subtle, really subtle problems, or there's real suffering and questioning over what a history of a certain kind of psychiatric illness means, I suggest that people contact him. He's often very, very helpful. So it's good that one of our own is the acknowledged expert. There are going to be a lot of halakha questions that are going to come up in the future because of the work of Gershon and others. Probably within the decade, we'll be able to do genetic testing for all kinds of psychiatric illness. So a girl, in addition to Dari Sharon, when you go out, you'll be able to know, there's a 10% risk of bipolar illness here, and a 20% risk of depression in your children.
Recessive or dominant?
Well, it won't be as simple as recessive or dominant. It's sort of like now with DNA. You can probably predict. You know, you have probably more like 40% chance of at least one of your children having an attention deficit.
Again, recessive or dominant?
You mean in terms of that?
Is it, you need two carriers to cause it?
No. Oh, you don't need two carriers. No, just based on the genetics.
Dari Sharon won't have a test for
it. Dari Sharon won't test for it.
Absolutely not.
But one day, the technology is going to bring us the possibility. I was just talking to some colleagues here about choice is sometimes associated with lower levels of happiness. Okay? So, So, for example, if you could go shopping for a car, okay, and back in the old days, you could only get a black Model T, that's it. It comes in one color, no accessories, that's it. But let's say today, in buying a car, when they do experiments, let's say you could choose from, 15 different colors, 10 different kinds of accessory packages, and this horsepower versus this horsepower, or let's say you have no choice at all, you're far more likely to be happy with what you get if you have no choices.
Neurotic rat.
As soon as there's choice, what's that?
When I was a kid, he was a neurotic rat. When he goes one way, it's one thing. When he has different ways to go, he gets crazy.
It's a good specialty as an animal psychologist to treat neurotic rats. Okay. But that's it. Yeah, choice is not necessarily, associated with happiness. What was I saying?
I'm sorry.
Right. So we're going to have, technically, and I hope halakhically we will not be allowed to do this. Technically.
we'll take away your choice.
Technically, the day will come God willing, in all of your lifetimes, okay? The day will come, and I'm not so sure it's going to be a good thing, that you'll be able to go to a shop, this is all just technical, and say, I want somebody, you know, with no risk for, you know, I'll be driven crazy if any of my kids have an attention deficit. I'm a very sympathetic person, and I'd be driven crazy if I have a wife who has any kind of risk for developing certain kinds of anxiety, and I want somebody with this temperament and this temperament, and I want pretty much a guarantee that my children will have this temperament and that temperament. Now, obviously, it's not going to mean anything, because, you know, we'll never be able to really have control of that point, but it could really cause tremendous problems on the shidduch thing, okay? If we're able to have that kind of choice, you know, you could really, and that's what's happening, actually, in the secular world, where there's a growing use of test tube babies, you know, where you can go and choose the father, okay? And women go with a list, a shopping list. I want somebody.
Single women?
These are single women go nowadays, and or you can have gay couples go.
Lesbian women,
or what? And they have a shopping list of what they're looking for. Now it's not on psychiatric stuff. They have a shopping list on physical characteristics. Now, so I want somebody who went, and in some situations you could only be dealing with Ivy League fathers, okay? In others, it could only be guys who are at least 6 feet tall, with a full head of hair, and you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Athletes.
That's what they look for. And it's a little scary. But anyway, that's it's all yours.
Thank you. The questions for later.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Let's get questions. I know this is all very, I sort of rambled more than I usually do, but because I know you've heard me talk. My real dating talk you've heard already. Yes.
In terms of someone setting up a say, I want to set up a friend who I know is on medicine.
Yeah.
Depression. So do I ask them, should I, or am I allowed to mention?
That's not a question. But I mean, the guidance that is often given, and this has to do with the stage theory of dating. Dating, depending on, you know, what world you're moving in, dating goes through stages, okay? Now, if you have somebody, let's say, who's on medication for depression, and the very first date you let the other side know that, it's going to be very hard for that person to really get to the point that they're given a fair chance. It's much more from a psychological standpoint. You want to wait till you hit the point where you're really beginning to deepen the relationship and get serious. And it's at that point that psychologically it makes sense. And I have a feeling that the halakha by like would be similar to that possibly. But that's often what I know with Dr. Tversky, for example, or Dr. Cohn often advise is to wait for that point. To go at, because otherwise nobody will ever get a fair chance. If they have even the slightest bit of problems, you know, requiring use of medication or invisible physical illnesses like gastrointestinal illnesses or diabetes or things like that. I've known many, many successful shidduchim, some miraculous, with people with serious medical challenges that never would have happened if either party had told about it until they were serious. And once they're serious, you know, serious in the sense of almost ready to talk topics, you know? And then at that point, but at the point that it is, that's a lot of questions. So that, right? So, yeah.
You know, I remember listening to a story that where a shaman asked the Rav without, throughout ever meeting the person or his psychologist, and just based on the shaman asking the Rav said that he couldn't tell the person, he didn't tell the Rav his side after, let's say, 6, 7 days, while this Rav never met
put into the list. We'll add the list of things to talk about.
Okay, okay, good. Yeah. Okay, good question. Other questions, yeah.
Shared dreams.
Shared dreams. Yeah, that's I know that's very vague. So the question is about shared dream. What does it mean by a shared dream? Shared dream means that you're more or less, you don't have to have identical hashkafas, and it doesn't even mean that you both have to agree to live in the same part of Ramat Beit Shemesh or whatever, you know? What it means is that you're more or less on the same page in terms of hashkafa. So, you know, to talk about, let's say, a modern couple. So So, you know, you can't have a couple where one person wants to send their kid to Ramaz and the other side wants to send their kid to Yeshiva Katana. I don't think so. I mean, that's not impossible, but you know that's, in other words, so there's such different hashkafas that you're on the opposite sides of the spectrum in terms of in terms of basic hashkafa. Or, you know, one person wants to have a flat screen TV and the other doesn't. That's not necessarily a deal breaker. But if one person says, I absolutely don't want to go to any movies, I don't want to have any media, and the other person says, absolutely not, I want to raise my kids to have, you know, I want that flat screen TV with internet access in my child's bedroom. Those are some of the basic issues. Shared dream has to do with child rearing philosophy, sort of where you want to be religiously, what your dreams are, learning as a major part of your life versus not, Torah values, and even in terms of, you know, will you accept a life of being married to a Machana with all the economic challenges that might bring, you know? And that's important, but that's going to play out in all kinds of ways. So I think those are predictive. If you look at what ends up in an office, in my office, that's often the root of where marital difficulties come from. Yeah, that's a good question. I think if you're heading in the same direction, and you clearly are on the same page with that, I think that's probably fine. You know, the fact that you come, there are many, many happily married Balei Tshuva. There are many, many which reminds me, there's one thing I didn't talk about. I didn't talk about children of divorce, and I think I should talk about that. It's a very important issue. I spoke about it to some of you guys in other contexts. But in terms of that, I think what matters is that you're more or less heading in the same direction. Now, there is a problem if somebody's still in the process of change and it's too soon. So there's a deep freeze issue. And I was like, you know, there's some wisdom behind people not going out within a certain amount of time after coming back from Eretz Yisrael, because there's still very much works in progress, and you may end up making a premature foreclosure. Now, I see...
Fresh facts
are very much still churning and are works in progress. Let me just say one thing about divorce, and I want to hear from you. I didn't say the children of divorce thing. Children of divorce thing is very important. What that's about is that a lot of people really need to be on top of this reality. The reality goes like this. Some of the best marriages I've ever seen are from children of divorce, okay? There's this myth out there that if you grew up and experienced a messy divorce, you're going to make a horrible husband or a horrible wife. The truth is yeah, you are at greater risk for having problems, but not nearly as much as you would think. At least 2/3 of kids who grow up in families where they're exposed to divorce grow up with a very, very strong desire to have shalom bayis. I have many people who grow up with that saying that it hurts them so much to fight that they'll do anything to avoid having an unnecessary fight. They know what suffering comes to children from fighting, and they make unbelievable husbands and wives. And I see that very, very often. The research shows, psychologists call it the magic of the ordinary, that resilience is the norm. Sure, we can talk about the failures, and sure, there's a percentage of people who we have to, the key is, if you're advising somebody who's going out with a child of divorce about what to do, just ask, what did they learn from it? If they're saying, oh, it didn't really affect me, and I'm not doing anything different because of it, then I'd be a little worried, but especially if there's some of the other warning signs. But if they say, you know something, I am really gonna be much more careful about this, this, and that, and that, you know, and they're really taking from it a lesson to make their marriage, and make shalom bayis the most important thing in their life, I would say that person, I know so many marriages that are successful with children who grew up in horrible, horrible divorce situations. So that's an important thing to know about.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's say from one of the other questions, that isn't it true that two people that are heading sometimes in the same direction to different backgrounds are veering away from the place, veering away from the place that they're coming from?
Yeah.
And therefore, the main clash is not themselves, but the in-laws, and it could be an even bigger problem.
Yeah, with in-laws. Yeah. But problems with in-laws is very important. We talked about this. We had a meeting on premarital therapy. Yeah.
It's not just in-laws. Yeah. Saying internally, since if they have a strong sense of family, then even if they're veering away from a certain kind of shkafa, from where they're coming from, they'll still have a lot of resentment towards each other.
It all depends. That doesn't mean it can't be worked out. That might be able to be worked out. You're right. That's something to keep in mind.
Right.
You know, to make for some... there's some very interesting meetings between, you know, the mechutanim when you have that kind of process. And sometimes there's terrible fighting. But, and very often you can play a very important role, those of you who are going to be cultivated as rabbis, very important role. When I first took the job here, you know, originally with the Wexner guys, 7-8 years back, kind of a fellow, you know, I was just doing pastoral psych here. I went around to different rabbis and I asked them, what do you think are some of the topics that I should be talking about? That's how I developed the curriculum for pastoral psych. Like, what comes across your desk? You know what number one was? Or I shouldn't say number one, but certainly in the top three, problems with in-laws. Now, I don't know how often that comes across your desk, but it's a real issue. It's probably, you know, and it's something that it's built into premarital therapy programs and whatever. Okay, any other questions before let's move on. I don't know.
We have some questions.
Yeah. We have enough to keep you busy for hours.
Well, I'll give them time for questions at the end. I'm going to ask you at the end also. I'll try to respond in order. The first question was the hardest. What do you do with the child that you know is not the child of the person he thinks is his father? I think you do nothing.
Thank God.
For the following reasons. Now, the first thing you say, what do you mean, do nothing? The kid obviously must be a mamzer, 100% mamzer. Has to be. If the mother's husband can't possibly be the father, there's a 100% chance of mamzeris. It's not even a question. So, yes?
Unnatural process of birth.
Right. She could have gone to a sperm bank. Number one, she could be a kosher of Freud. She just didn't want to tell her husband anything, so she just went to a sperm bank, an artificial insemination. Maybe the husband even knows about it, unbeknownst to this person who came to you. And worst case scenario, that the woman is unfaithful, but maybe the father is a goy, the natural father. The natural father is a goy. The child is kosher. Some kedushin is here. So there are ways that we can call kasha the child, even though the wife's husband is not his biological father. So I would do nothing. Fine.
Any responsibilities in terms of Asur Labala?
Again, she is Asur Labala, whether the boyfriend was a Jew or a guy, she's still to be passing through the ballot anyway. But
here the idea of there not being nemanah, that
right.
she's not saying I was dishonored, right? She's not saying anything. Here we have DNA evidence.
But the DNA evidence only proves that the child it could have been artificial insemination. And she would say, yes, it's true, but I was artificially inseminated.
I hear what you're saying.
Okay. And then she's not a surreal about.
Oh, I see. So the same
stuff. I'm still wondering if the person who came to you with out of confidentiality knows the facts. Maybe the father knows full well the children are not. How did she know that he doesn't know?
Yeah.
Maybe they went to artificial insemination. Maybe they came to me, I gave them answers.
I
don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, I would just leave.
It's a wild question. If it hadn't happened earlier this week,
okay.
I wouldn't have started.
Okay. Now, as far as when you tell, if you tell, it's a very serious problem. Very, very serious problem. There's a range of halachic opinion. The Gemara tells the Masechta Yevamot on that Memhei. around that, somewhere around that Panay, that it was a case of an individual who couldn't get married because his father was not Jewish. No one wanted to marry him. Who wants to marry a person whose father is not Jewish? He was told by the Amoroi to go hide, go to a faraway town where no one knew his background, and get married there. So the stipler, the Kilas Yaakov and Yevamos, asked the question, why? How is it allowed to hide such an important shortcoming? His father is not Jewish. If you did something in an analogous case, if you want to sell a car, and you hide a major problem that has a transmission, you know, which right now is not noticeable, but you would be guilty of honor, which is parsha. Might it be a rise to the level of megachsos? So how can it be that you can hide such a basic piece of information that the father is a guy from the woman and her family? That's his question. Very good question. So his answer is equally remarkable. His answer is, you can't compare people to cars. In a car, in a house, you're required to reveal all shortcomings. Why? Because the same house and the same car could be purchased without the shortcoming. So it's unfair of you to hide the shortcoming because the person could have bought exactly the same car without that shortcoming. Even if it's a relatively minor shortcoming, if you don't reveal it, you are guilty of bad faith. However, when it comes to people, it's not that way. You cannot say that, you know, here's a man or a woman with a certain shortcoming, and we'll just pull another one off the shelf. So it's the exact same person without that shortcoming. It doesn't work that way. So, for example, if you know, you have a growth on your big toe, a little pimple or something, you know, it's been there since birth, a birthmark. And of course, you're wearing shoes and socks, so that this girl doesn't know about it. So you're required to tell her you have a growth, pimple on your big toe? Okay, put you away, I'll clone you with someone who's the same guy, but you just doesn't have the pimple on the big toe. You can't find such a person on the shelf. And therefore, you don't have to tell. So how far do you go? The disciple goes remarkably far in this. The disciple says that obviously there are some things you have to tell, but his standard is mind-boggling. Is the only time you have to tell is a case in which if the other person would find out after the marriage about this shortcoming, that they would walk out. That's an amazingly high standard. That's an unbelievably high standard. And you tell them the day after the wedding, you know, I have this and this shortcoming, they'd walk out. Anything less than that, according to the staff, but you don't have to tell. Wow. Now, many years ago, I had a Talmud who was a med student, and he was going out with a girl. I think they were engaged, if I'm not mistaken. It's been so many years. I believe they were engaged. And after the engagement, he was told of a medical problem. He came to me and said, well, Rebbe, should I go through with this wedding? It's a medical problem. And he went all the way down at the time to Johns Hopkins, which was the number one center in the country in this particular medical problem. And they gave him the research, the chances, you know, the chances of this woman leading a normal longevity, and the chances of children having this particular issue. And he was, what should I do? He asked me. So I said, listen, I can't tell you what to do. Whatever you decide to do, you do. I mean, it's your choice. He broke it up. I got an irate phone call from the family, screaming and yelling at me, and I was so angry. I think they understood that I was the one who told them to break it up. And maybe the boy in a tough spot was little bit loose with the facts. I mean, I didn't say, it's true, I didn't say, you know, I didn't bring it up. That's true. But, you know, that's going to be, you know, the game of telephone. So I made a trip. It was an almana with a yatom. The father, husband, had died of this very syndrome. And I was familiar with the family. So I don't think I ever met them personally. I knew the nifter. He was a public figure. I went to the house to get yelled at. I went to get yelled at. I went to be the punching bag. They'd be angry at me, and you know, let them get out of their system. Part of klamon of yosam lo sa'anun is not just that you shouldn't hurt them, but you should try to make them feel better in any which way. So I'll just seem to take it, you know. So the lady says to me, the mother, you know, I want to tell you a story. When my daughter became of marriageable age, I went to my local rabbi to ask him, what must I do in terms of divulging? He said, you know, it's a tough question, let's go to the Rav. And I got in the plane and went to Boston. This woman, this almana, with the rabbi. And the Rav said, don't tell. You don't have to tell. Again, that's how it was quoted to me, I wasn't in Boston. And that's why I didn't tell. And so they got engaged. But I couldn't live with myself, says the mother. I just couldn't live with myself. I said, this is not right. This is just wrong. So I told my daughter she has to tell. Together we told her. And she said to me, and this is our reward. We went with Snib Mishur of Adin. We told we're of Salavesh, so we don't have to tell. And that's our reward. We get a patch and the guy breaks up the shidduch. And I'm the one sitting there like this, and they're crying and they're yelling and they're angry. The chule. You know, to the best of my knowledge, he got married, she got married, they both are happy with their respective marriages, you know. Put things in perspective all the time. But that's what I heard. But the Rav said not to tell, I guess he must have had the same halakha as a stipler. As if this was a difficult syndrome, but someone told us the day after the wedding, I don't think it would work out. So, the first question, if you have to tell. My view has always been that whether the stipler's position is correct or incorrect, but it's proper to tell. And the time that one should tell, I believe, by the way, I was told that the stipler of Makutz, which Rabbi Yashem Shalita, argued with the stipler, with his Makutz, and said the only time you don't have to tell is in a family situation. There's nothing wrong with that boy. Just his yichus wasn't perfect. His father was a god. But if it was intrinsic, some kind of illness, I was told Rabbi Yashem said, you can't bring a rifle like a man you love. Kaf shamati. When do you tell, in my view, is halfway through the relationship. It's like a half line. You never know exactly when that is. But if it, again, depends on your circle. So if you're in a circle where they typically will go out for 3 months, so if you're 6 weeks into it, you should tell. You know, they go out 3 months and they date it once a week. So that's where you have the 6 dates theory. Fine. In some circles, these are more intense and they go out 12 times, but all within, who knows, 1 month. So I would still go with the, then I go into 2 weeks, which is the halfway point. Whatever the halfway point is, that's what you should tell. I will speak from my own experience. I had individuals who had diabetes. Diabetes is a significant medical problem. There is a somewhat reduced life expectancy. There can be issues with children as well. There is a genetic component. And I was, you know, I told the particular individuals who asked me, it was more than one, tell halfway through. Both people I told, they told halfway through. The young lady and the family accepted it. And, you know, Baruch Hashem, Alavaya, Tol Meves Hashanah, in both cases there are healthy children and there are healthy marriages. And we hope that they will in fact be healthy and the children be healthy for Amei Aviyatri. Clearly, there are a whole range of situations. I gave you examples of different situations. I gave you one, diabetes. Something called Marfan syndrome. and what that is. So it's a medical condition, genetic. These are all physical things. There are a whole range of physical ailments which are, you know, there are people who have, we know, known to have cancers either themselves or in their family. Now the BRCA 1, the BRCA 2, it's a whole situation. I've always felt it's important to test. I don't believe in hiding things. But there were those who disagreed strongly. The Hasidic circles and the Afedor Yisharim, anything beyond that, they're very, very much opposed. They're afraid it's going to traumatize the person who was told that he's a carrier or she's a carrier, but it's meaningless. Even in a recessive case, what's meaningless, you're a carrier. How much more so is it traumatized if it's not meaningless, if it's something which is not recessive? You know, there are only two carriers to cause a problem with respect to children. But these things exist. Everyone has something. Everybody's carrying something. It's a reality. I do feel that the secrecy kills idea is true. People that will hold against you not the fact that you had it, but the fact that you didn't reveal it. I can tell you stories. Actually, I know that there was a certain person who had, in fact, a medical condition and was revealed after the wedding. And one mechutz told the other, I don't know if you're accusing me, but I'm telling you, I did not know about this at the time of the wedding. Shouldn't think that one mechutz told that. Shouldn't think that I hid it from you. And in saying this, I think he quoted from Rav Hanan Leibowitz as one of his svarim that a person should. The yeast of the Kiyan. If you think that someone may suspect you, you should say it up front. Don't suspect them. I don't think the person suspected him, but don't suspect them. In case I know that. So clearly there's an entire range of medical and psychiatric, psychological conditions that have to be judged on a case-by-case basis. Generally speaking, I believe that telling is the best way to handle it. I'm speaking about the person himself or herself should tell the other potential spouse. I also had a question yesterday, so this is one. This is where shatchanim can get, or people who are asked information can really get hammered. A lady called me yesterday. Someone called the information about a particular boy, and they said in passing, and I know that they have this boy and the sister was divorced. But all right, anything can happen. I'm not going to hold it. I'm not going to break it up, or I'm not going to stay away from this shidduch because of this situation. Yes, the lady to me, but I know that this boy has two sisters who were divorced, and apparently the friend of mine who called us does not know that. Should I say that there are two sisters who are divorced? In which case, if they break it up or don't go out, my friend, she's a friend of both, who has this boy would be angry at me. Or should I not say, and then when they find out later that their two sisters were divorced, and they'll say to me, wait a minute, I told you it was only there was one sister, you didn't correct me, obviously you're hitting for me, a chutzpah. See? Yeah, what they say, damned if you do and damned if you don't.
Yes. Double bind.
You're stuck. Yeah, there's no way out of this one. So I listened, and I heard which way she was leaning. She wanted to tell. I said, you want to tell? So tell. I think it's permissible to tell. I brought with my Sefer Chofetz Chaim, which gives you the seven, we spoke about it recently in a different forum, the seven conditions that are necessary to be able to say something which is Mitzoeles. One, you have to know it yourself. It should be a rumor. Two, you shouldn't jump to conclusions. You see something, but you don't know what you see. Right? That's a famous story which is in the book called The Other Side of the Story. Right? Rabbi Salmon, I believe, is the one who wrote that. If I'm not mistaken. Yehuda Walker, Salmon?
Walker.
That's right. You know her from the old Parakwe days? That's right. She wrote that book. Number three, if it's relevant, you should first give musr to the offender. That doesn't apply to these medical conditions, but to other chesronis. Four, you shouldn't exaggerate the problem. five most important. Sheyachav l'toelis. You have to have in mind only for the sake of what's good. You shouldn't have any hanah from, you know, I hate the guy, or I want to show it, or I'm a busybody, I know everything, and you don't know. Six, is you can achieve this toelis without some other eight that you require to do so. And seven, there shouldn't be a greater hezek, damage to the person, more than the din requires. Now obviously, not that this is not doing shiduchim, but the general criteria do apply. You have to know it, and you have to have in mind only for the toelis. Again, according to the Seifer, there's another condition. You have to be so such a bad shortcoming that the person would want to walk out afterwards, which is itself hard to measure, frankly. I've once spoke about that. What'll happen is my cycle that I created. Maybe you can help me out of this, get off this cycle over here. Listen to this. There is a problem. But if the person found out about it after the marriage, they wouldn't walk out. But they would only walk out because of the chutzpah of the other side of the hiddenness. So what happened in the following case? This is the problem which even the boy and his family don't know about. I know about it. They don't even know about it. I'm a doctor. I discovered something. I never told them about it. And I don't tell them about it. Okay? They get married. The next day I have an appointment. Knock, knock. I want to speak to the boy, the new chos, the kalan, both sets of mechutanos. I said, I did something, which you may be angry at me for, but I withheld information from the chos that he has a certain medical problem. Didn't tell him. He doesn't know, his parents don't know. But now I'm telling you, all six of you in one shot, he has X. That kind of case. The kala, the new kala, and mother and father will say, all right, now I don't know if we would have gotten this in the first place, but I'm not walking out now. But the exact same scenario, same disease, same problem, whether it be physical or mental, same exact case. The day after the wedding, the kala tells the chos, tells the kala, I have X. She says, why did you tell me? Goes back to her parents, and the three of them have a huddle, and she wants to walk out on them. Why? Because they never told. But then, they'll have another huddle. They'll bring in the stifler, and he'll say, I told him he shouldn't tell. How do you get off that merry-go-round? Follow what I'm saying? It's not objectively ground enough that they'd walk out after the wedding. Okay. But they'd walk out after the wedding because of chutzpah, they didn't tell us. But that chutzpah is mitigated, but if we went to a rabbi who told us, we didn't have to tell you. Now we're back to the first scenario. Something to think about. Yes?
A way to get off when those policies turn around, what if you make up a doctor's appointment the day after the chuppah, and the doctor reveals to the chassan, and the chassan then reveals to his wife, this is what I just found out. But then, on the flip side, wouldn't it be, you should tell us, because he really knew beforehand, and how does she know that he knows why I'm referring to you?
Around and around and around. Yes.
Once the Roth says it's okay, doesn't that stop the merry-go-round? Once he can say, I have a Roth that says that I didn't have to tell you that. It should.
I agree with you, but it's not so simple. Yeah.
Right.
No. So it could be that Rabbi Yashiv, again, I don't really say it, it's all just Mipi HaShmur. He might have only said in the case where the only chesaron was in the yichus, in the covenant of the yichus, that the father's a guy, he could be a very healthy guy. He may not say that in the case where the father is a schizophrenic, where it's not just a matter of what his yichus is in terms of covenant, but it may have impact on the children of this new marriage.
See, if one of the spouses are fine, it's just that
I repeat, if it's not genetic in nature, the parent has a problem, well, the parent's a crook. I hope it's not genetic in nature. Right? And then you don't tell anybody about that. So Rabbi Yoshua would say that would fit into this Gemara. The father's a guy, the father's a crook, the father's a this and this and this and this. Even though there may be certain predispositions, I don't go into that now, but fundamentally the child is okay. That's what he said, that he's limiting it to that kind of a case.
Yeah, so
why. I'm not processing anything. I'm just going to tell you over what I think. Okay. These are all very serious questions, and I don't know the answers to all of them. And I would, you know, I always say case by case basis. Let's give you some of the guidelines. The type of skiddush is a tremendous skiddush. I don't believe that the rabbanim today go that far, and I can understand why. But someone who does go that far, you know, they went to Rabbi Soloveitchik and said, "Don't reveal it." Right? So you understand why this mother and daughter felt betrayed, but they weren't betrayed. They chose on their own to reveal it, and they, you know, live with the consequences. And that's the way it is. I think they're better off for it, frankly. Long term, that day they were very happy. So that's why I think it's as far as this general idea. Now, the endless details to fill in it is endless. So many problems. Are they problems? Are they not problems? Right. As a matter of fact, you can look it up in the Oter Poskim. He has a whole list of shortcomings, which are legitimate or not legitimate to break up a shidduch. That's extraordinarily relevant in time of these poskim, because there were monetary penalties that were accepted by each side if they should break up the engagement without sufficient cause. That could be big bucks. And I find out this about the father, this about the uncle, this about the sister, this about this psychological problem. You should look at this. I'm giving you a marmuk, which is an invaluable gold mine for you.
Yeah.
It's an Oter Poskim. I think it's the early nuns in Eben Ezer. They rattle off. And of course, they didn't have as much genetic information as we have, but they talk to you about the Shanda, about the genetics. The Shanda, they find out that the Kala's brother converted to Christianity. Ah, scandal. But the uncle is a lowlife. That should be enough. I don't want to get involved in that. I'm out. It's considered, but many folks consider it to be a legitimate ground to break up a shidduch. Now, not that they would necessarily break up the marriage if they were already married, but they found out about it. I can tell you a story I know about, that a couple adopted a child, and they were told not to say the child was adopted. And the years gone by with the child, I don't know if the child knew, or didn't know, the Mechotan didn't know. Today everything's up, it's hard to imagine this case these days, but they didn't tell. If I'm not mistaken, the child was already engaged to a girl from an extraordinarily prominent rabbinic family. And somebody blew the whistle. And said that, hey, you know, are you aware of the fact that this cousin's a great guy? You're aware that he's an adopted child? Whoop! So the father of this Kala was a mental health professional. I guess it runs in his rabbinic family. He went to his extraordinarily prominent rabbinical father, and the father called in his son and his granddaughter, and he said, "He's a good boy. I'll give you my bracha." He gave the brachas of the shidduch, and everything was fine and dandy, and they were living happily with many children, all of them were wonderful, tremendous, all because of the vision of this great rabbi. One word from him would have knocked the whole thing off. Now, they came to time. Why don't you tell us? The response was, you said, we were told enough to tell. It's the Gemara's case. Right? That's the Gemara's case, because they hid the yichus. There wasn't anything intrinsically wrong with this boy. I know the story firsthand.
So the stifler is, it isn't the rishus. Is what the implication of the stifler is that you're not allowed to tell?
No.
No,
you don't have to tell.
You don't have to tell.
And the rabbis encouraged his fellow, because on a shidduch, zil it ma'azal shemayim, go high, go to a faraway place where no one knows about it. They encouraged it. Not that they, you know, is it a shatat, I guess, but it's always a shatat time. It's always going to be a shatat time by definition, these kinds of cases. Yes, sir?
Only the person himself, you know, he's allowed to hide it according to the stifler, but he can say if he wants, but can someone else?
Can someone else hide it?
Yeah. Can someone else say it?
Can someone else say it? I can't answer that. Can someone else hide it? It's a double question. If someone asks you, or certainly if you're confronted head on, is anything wrong with this family? I get these catch-all phrases. I get called all the time by shidduchim. Is there anything that you have to tell us about this? Those are the worst. I said, can you be more specific? I don't want to be trapped in that kind of a question. Be more specific. You know, people want everything. They want about looks. That's what people get derived about looks. I would say, I don't look at women. I once got in trouble. When I was much younger. I didn't know any better. So I always said, you have to answer everything because it's going to be fine anyway. So I asked about the girl. I said, what a phrase I use, that she's not the most gorgeous, whatever. The kids, he got back to the family. He was furious at me. Yentas. So I learned my lesson. I don't look at women. That's my last, my official one. I want to say, come on. Benos Yisrael Yomasein. I always quote that Gemara in Shabbos.
That's the same giveaway.
Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Whatever it means. It's hard to know. In all these situations, each one is a whole, it's a human life on both sides. It's either, what I call Dina Nefashos question. And I can give you a list of questions I've received about this. The whole range. Psychiatric problems, medical problems, you know. Previous marriage problems, you know. I get the question that this woman was married before a certain man, and the man is now going to get engaged again. And I know for a fact that this man abused his first wife. I know it, so it was involved directly. Do you tell? Don't you tell? You know the history of someone who was in his teenage years was all kinds of wild stuff, and do you tell or don't you tell? These are always grading questions. Do you give unsolicited advice? Two questions. You know, lo sama al dam reyecha. Chavetz Chaim is over here. If you know something, you don't say, lo sama al dam reyecha. You know, the person, the first story that Dr. Pelton was told of the guy who was a borderline, married a woman who he knew was borderline or whatever it was, these kinds of particular psychiatric issues, and if someone knew about it and didn't tell him, that person was over the Lothal Dharma Yechah. All these crying, and he's got half a box of tissues, and kids were all mixed up, because no one told this guy at the time what borderline means. It's nothing, it's borderline. It's what it meant, you know, you're on the border of being a perfect match and a less than perfect match. It's a term of art, it means something. It's delusional in many ways. It means that. So there are so many cases.
By the way, on the other end, you just raised the common question of, let's say somebody acted up in high school. You know, what does that say about the future? More often than not, it probably says very little about the future. Okay? Especially if it's a guy. Okay? If it's a guy who acted up during high school and then did shuva and continued to, you know, so he...
It's very little in terms of predictive. But there's also what some might call the Shanda aspect. I'm gonna marry this guy. They tell me now he's the best bacher in this yeshiva. Then I find out that maybe that's true at the present time, but he did certain things when he was 17, 18, 19 years old, which are halakhically prohibited, and I don't want to be of any part of it. Or maybe he was a drug addict at that some point in his life. Even if you say now he's like clean for 5 years, so it's no longer. But it wants a Shanda. On the other hand, as I said, you can't get the same boy without that shot, without that background. These are all difficult questions, and I have no pat answer to these questions. I don't claim to have any. Yes?
Also, let's say I want to ask, you know my sister's married, but I don't want to have open marriage, so I just told me to mention this guy that I know in high school, she did certain things, so am I even allowed to call that my sister?
If you feel that your sister would not want to go out with a boy or marry a boy that had this kind of a history, of course you should tell her. You must tell her.
It's like, I'm eventually, once she gets to know a guy, she probably considers it wrong, but she has a choice to go out with a guy.
I've often been yelled at by people because I follow my own advice and I don't tell the very beginning, and then they find out halfway through the dating process and they walk away. Why did you tell me? Calmly respond. Well, maybe you wouldn't care about it. But maybe I would care about it. I said, well, maybe you wouldn't. And if you did a great guy, a great girl, and if you wouldn't care about it, it'd be a perfect shidduch. So I told him, I gave him instructions to say at a certain point, if your child went through, wasted 6 weeks of his or her life, and then I got into some emotional baggage, so yell at me. I'm yelled at for so many other things, so what's the one with the, I don't know. All right. I certainly agree with the with what was said before about the if there's a harsh start up and putting down. It's I love the coincidence. I don't know if Dr. Cousins appreciated it. He gave two statistics about the myth of instant soulmates. He said that 94% were looking for it. Then he quoted from the good professor who said it's a 94% prediction of the who. It's the same number. I don't know if you picked that up.
Same number. It is. And it is.
It's fascinating. So you can make a note of that. Yes.
Sad.
Okay. Sad and sod. Okay. Yes, there has to be an attraction for sure. That's the Gemara Miss Kiddushin of Hamal. It's the first stop many of us learned this year. You have to see the girl, and the lack of attraction, you shouldn't go out. I feel strongly that you have to be very careful and go out for a longer period of time than is in certain other circles. In certain other circles, they simply live a simpler life. In a simpler life, you know, life is simpler. There are fewer criteria. What did you say, call them before? Fewer accessory packages that they're choosing between. It works out. But in our world, I think they have to go out more frequently. They should go out more often, many more times. The story is told, I may have heard this from you before, that the late Rav Moshe Bick, the Zichrono Levracha, wrote a long article in what was then the Morgen Journal, the Yiddish papers, in which he said that he was seen as terrible things that people don't like long enough. He makes a gzera, you cannot get engaged until you go out 8 times.
How many?
Eight times. Which in his circles was a tremendous, unbelievably liberal. He probably said, he probably went to YU, that's where he gets it comes from. Never got out of his system. Yeah. So, sure enough, he was savaged by the Satmar Rebbe, the Chorin of the Rebbe. And the Satmar Rebbe, Rav Yoelish, who said about Rav Moshe Bick, they're both living in Brooklyn at the time. He said, "Katzi b'chayai b'pnei b'nos ches." Ches, 8 times. He's very sharp. I can't stand that the Rabbi Bick is saying to go out 8 times. It's ridiculous. Much too much. A few times, 3 times is enough. But 8 times is ridiculous. What was the rejoinder of Rav Moshe Bick? He said, "Sat merov." He's a big Masada Kiddushin. He's doing it all the time. But ich bin a Masada Git. He doesn't know about that. I pick up the pieces. And all of his 2-3 time dates, and then they get married, I pick up the pieces. That was his response. So, you know, it's what to be learned from everybody. The idea of the in-laws getting in the way, it was brought up in towards the end, a very serious problem. Extraordinarily serious problem. Ultimately, they have to be told, and here I volunteer to any couple, anybody in this room gets married and have a problem with the in-laws, I volunteer, call me. I'll be the bad guy. Well, I will tell the whoever they are that butt out. Butt out. That's it. It's nothing to do with you. They're married, and then leave them alone. What do you mean a chutzpah? And they're not doing this and they're doing that, and they went there and they didn't come here, and these Narish guys, this little Havel Havolim. On the other hand, when the boy is going out with the girl, and they're just going in the dating process, and the parents have something to say, I believe that very often there's a lot to be learned from the parents, and the child should not ignore what they say. Everyone quotes the Ramah. Yerodeh and the Siman Reish Mem, the very last Ramo, says that, according to the Chumash Ma'arik, that a boy wants to get married and the father says, no, you're not required to listen. Everyone, every boy knows that. But you gotta look more carefully, you gotta look more deeply. The Chazon Ish, explaining that Ma'arik, tells us, But the reason why is because the father is making an unreasonable request. He's asking the son not to marry the girl of his choice. It's an unreasonable request. The child is not required to obey an unreasonable request. However, what if the request is reasonable? The parents are making perfect sense. This girl is not for their son. She has bad midos, for example. Clearly bad midos. So the Titzel Eliezer says in that kind of a case that the child should listen to his, obey his parents. He doesn't see it. He's smitten by a good looks or whatever, a charm. He doesn't see the bad midos. But of course, who decides? Who decides? The father says my request is reasonable, and the son says it's not reasonable. Like anything else in halacha, who decides? The rav decides, of course. Who's rav? And has a rav. Of course, it's the child's rav. It's the child's child. Does he have to obey the parents or not? So if the rav tells the child that your parents' request is reasonable, stop going out with this girl because she has terrible midas, then the child should obey his parents. If the father tells the son, stop going out with this girl because the father is barely earns a living and is not from a prominent family, so again, if I'm the rabbi, I would say that the father is being ridiculous and that the child is not required to obey the parents. Required or not required, it's tough to go against parents in this kind of situation. It can be extraordinarily difficult and it may not be worth it. So the strict halacha is one thing and what's good advice is another thing. But of course, good advice should not be only given to children, it should be given to parents as well. Sometimes the child won't hear advice from his parents or not. And therefore the parents in effect destroy the relationship before it starts. But that's okay, that's a halva tzara. But to destroy it after already they got married, that's not fair. You didn't have to engage, it's not fair. You knew this before, you should have spoken up earlier. It's not right. It's just very wrong. There are parents who feel that this girl is not for my son. My son is God's gift to humanity. Some boys think that way for themselves. That's another problem. But even the boys don't think that, the parents sometimes think that. This Chuas Marik is about a very interesting story. As long as the issue of what they call Hogenes Lo is appropriate for him, so the Marik says that the parents shouldn't protest. There's a whole fight, what's Hogenes Lo? The Netziv writes, it's from an inappropriate family, and it's going to be a bizarre to the father. That's considered to be included in the Marik Chuv. So Rabbi Vosner, Shalita, has a counterproof. Because the case that the Marik is discussing is a very terrible case. The son was flirting with this woman while she was still married to somebody else. Huh? So the Marik writes towards the end of the Chuvah, well, if the circumstantial evidence that there was actual znus between them is strong enough, they may not marry. They may not marry. Nitzan alayshin tish, gemar nivamos. But, says the Marik, if it doesn't rise to that level, then the father has no right to stand in the way, and the child need not listen. Says the Vosner, see for me, anything short of a really bad situation, the parents cannot intervene. In my view, that's no proof at all. Because there's a key word in that phrase. Eina hogenes lo. Who was flirting with this woman? She was still married. This son of theirs. So they deserve each other. We say in America, they deserve each other. He's a bad guy. He's immoral and she's immoral. So they stop short of the ultimate immorality. So they deserve each other. So the father who thinks my chaim, the big tzaddik, should go with this woman who was flirting when she was married to another man. Yeah, that was your chai. That was the other man. So she's okay, that's low. They're meant for each other. But if, in fact, if your son is really the best guy in the yeshiva, right? But he's somehow smitten by this girl's good looks or her charm, and the father thinks, chai, you're making a terrible mistake. It's not for you. And the rav sees it's taka not for him. Tzadikah is in touch and he listens to the father, that kind of a case. The parents request is reasonable. No. Breaking up engagement is not easy. I just speaking, we met at a different forum, was it? Yeah, 2 days ago. I talk about this rash of broken engagement, I mentioned that in that conversation. I mean, I have been, quote unquote, presided over the breakup of an engagement 1 week before the wedding. It was wrong. Girl had anger fits. I saw right away in front of me. She couldn't control her anger. I said to the boy, I mean, he called me an rabbi. He was on the rocks. I said, I presided over together with her rabbi. I was his rabbi, and her rabbi was one of the rabbi's rabbi. I would say, but it's a story of many years ago. And he was, and we both decided this has to break up, and it broke up a week before. On the other hand, just today, so it's anecdotal. Today I was at a bris. And someone who's a Rebbe in the yeshiva comes over to me, and is there someone, there are problems with a couple, they're going, they're engaged, and they have problems with it, and maybe they should break it up. So I told him, there's only one address. You have to go to someone who's, I think he's been here, I think. His name is Shai Astro. Was he ever here?
We had him this year.
I said, he is a pro's pro. I can tell you of a case, I was involved in it directly. But it was a guy who had such cold feet. The guy was ready to break up the wedding till mamash the last week. Into the last week. We're no longer seeing each other. He still wanted to break it up. I had cold feet. And this guy, Astravi, held the hand. And I mean, the jury's obviously out until 120 years, but Abir Tashem is going to be happily married forever. And then, from what I saw, he was A1. So people who have these kinds of problems should certainly go. The question whether anybody should go for premarital counseling, that's we spoke about it in a different forum. But all this has to do with what you should say and not say. If you see something, what do you hear now on the traffic reports? If you're seeing what we're not saying, so call this number. I volunteer, you call me. If you're seeing what no one is saying, call me. Or call Dr. Pelkovitz, you volunteer as well. Call Dr. Pelkovitz, okay. And
I'll
say,
send you Rabbi Wolf.
Well, there are cases where you know maybe something is amiss and no one's picking it up. Lo sama lo tamra, yes, it goes both ways. On the one is an Isser of Rechilus, you're on a tightrope. On the one is an Isser of Rechilus, which is an Isser Gomer. On the other is Isser lo sama lo tamra. How do you know? I can't give you the answer to all your questions. We wrestle with it, we think about it all the time. Both in terms of prospective Shidduchim, people who are going out, people who are already engaged. It's all part of this difficult decision. So I guess my time is more or less up. If you have any last minute questions, I'm happy to take them. Yes?
The question, are the retarded children deserving
of it? Oh, yes, I didn't get to talk about that. If someone is in the halachic category of a shota, he's shotesh, he's puzzled for the mitzvah of furu. The halachic category of a shota is a difficult question to know. Probably shota is not the right word for retarded. The word is petty. That we use. Yeah. And which Rabbi Kohn, Rabbi Shefta, is close to the category of Kherish. It's not his deranged, psychotic, that's a shota, but simply is limited. How limited is limited? He can't, he can never get to reach the intelligence of a typical bar mitzvah. Put it that way. That's one possible criteria. He'll never reach this intelligence of the average bar mitzvah. That's a pretty high standard. So, you know, 12 year olds are pretty bright. So if a guy will reach the level of a 12-year-old, he and she's an 11-year-old, so he may be a shota kohen halacha, maybe, but they can still live a happy life. Even if he's potter from puru, technically, maybe they should get married so they can have marital happiness. But we need our Dr. Gershon to tell us, what are the chances the children are also going to be retarded?
Right, and who's going to care for them?
Leave out who's going to care for them. If they're going to be healthy, well, where are we going to pay for them? And we're just perpetuating more and more retardation. That's not mitzvah. So, what are the offhand statistics?
I don't know. It's an unnecessary conflict because true mental retardation has so many different causes and so many different subtypes.
So, maybe we'll meet Dr. Gershon here for the next session. Or at least we should get some papers from him. Pull him up. I'd like to know if he's not going to come. Give me an article.
Are there good articles on
that? Has to be something. Has to be.
I'll ask Sean Fiber. I mean, I know he asked.
Yeah.
If someone knows that their children are going to be retarded, not like nothing matters, just like, you know, they're going to be slow. There's no mitzvah for a roof for them.
I didn't say that. Here, there's only a case where the parents are presently in the category of a shelter. Let's say a person is told by Leah Navi, listen, mister, you can have all the children you want, but everyone is going to be retarded. Well, they have fulfilled this mitzvah in that manner. Let's say he'll be told that his children will never be able to marry themselves. They're not b'nei hoki to marry. You have to fill peruvu by having children who themselves can marry and have children of their own. That's what he said. So that may have relevance to this kind of question, but I don't think such a case exists. In the case a person tells me, and he's told the only child he could possibly have to be retarded, I don't think it exists. Don't think so. Any other questions? Okay, the time is up. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Dr. Thank you.
What if both parents are retarded, but they're above the level of 13? They wouldn't be.